This is The Hindu on Books, a weekly podcast from India's national newspaper on the latest and the best from the world of literature.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Hindu on Books podcast. I'm your host, D. Sampath. The late Ram Vilas Paswan was a steady presence in national politics for more than four decades. He has held cabinet posts in several governments, including stints in key ministries such as railways and telecom. He is one of the faces associated with the historic implementation of the Mandal Commission report on OBC reservations. As someone adept at sensing shifts in political climate before others could, he was able to make the most of his political capital. But what exactly is his legacy as a Dalit leader? A new biography titled Ram Vilas Paswan, The Weather Vane of Indian Politics, offers a nuanced answer to this question. In the process, it also offers fascinating insights into Bihar politics and national politics of the 1980s, 90s, and the early 2000s. In this episode of On Books, we are joined by the biography's author, Shobana K. Nair, who also happens to be my colleague at The Hindu. She is deputy editor in our political bureau in New Delhi. Shobana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sampath. Thank you for having me.
So Shobana, I really enjoyed going through the book, and I found some really informative sections and fascinating, you know, kind of glimpses of politics in the later last two decades of the last century, so to speak. So I was just wondering, how did you come up with the idea for a book like this? I mean, he's a fascinating guy, no doubt. What inspired you to get started on a project like this?
Yeah, so the genesis of this book was actually a very curious conversation I had with Ram Vilas Paswan in August 2018. I had gone to meet him in the context of the arrests of five activists and academics, Varvara Rao, Arun Ferreira, Sudha Bharadwaj, Vernon Gonsalves, and Gautam Navlakha. All the five people were picked up by the Pune police for being members. I mean, the allegation against them, the so-called allegation against them, was that they were members of the banned organization CPI Maoist, and they incited violence during the Elgar Parishad, which was called to commemorate the 200th anniversary of Battle of Bhima Koregaon. Now, this 1818 battle was perhaps the first Dalit assertion in the region, because the Dalit soldiers of the British army, mostly Mahars, defeated the troops of local Brahmin ruler Peshwa Bajirao. Now, it was only obvious that as the most prominent Dalit face of the Modi government, I thought he would have something to say. And more importantly, on the label of urban naxals that was being freely distributed by the government. When I asked him for his remarks, he cringed at the phrase. And after remaining quiet for a few minutes, he said, "You know what? A little bit of naxalism is essential. Rights aren't granted. They need to be snatched." I jumped at it and asked him if he was willing to go on record. Of course not. It was out of question. I mean, he didn't want to risk his cabinet berth for one remark. And it underlined the basic contradiction between this man's personal beliefs, his political convictions, and the front that he presented as a minister in the Narendra Modi government. And, you know, as a storyteller, what else does one want except for a tale full of drama, full of twists, full of dizzying heights and despairing lows? And his story had all of it. I mean, when you ask me why Paswan, my answer is straightforward. Here it was a man who has served with six prime ministers of varying ideological commitments. And he started out as a Congress baiter. In the first three decades of his career, he was equally critical of the Jansangh and its later version, the Bharatiya Janata Party. And then he ends his career, last 6 years of his career, serving as Prime Minister Narendra Modi's lead cheerleader. So those contradictions were something that I thought are worth recording. And also the last point here that I would like to say is that he was also the 5 decades that he spent in Delhi. He was a quintessential Lutyens Delhi being, because he witnessed firsthand the events that have shaped our country. And so, I mean, I hope that answers your question.
Right. No, thank you for that, Shobhana. It really explains, you know, the attraction or the pull for a storyteller with a character like this. I mean, he is a man of many contradictions. When I remember when I think in the introduction, you talk about his sympathies for the Naxal movement, right? I mean, not just in the introduction, but also in his own life, he has been sympathetic to Naxals. And at one point, you quote, I think, Karpuri Thakur or maybe J.P. Narayan, who listens to his speech and tells him, "Toda sayam rakhna chahiye," and it should be more balanced. You're so too much of an extremist. But then, say, on page 61, I have your book open in front of me. I mean, you also say that he was a pathological pacifist. I mean, within 60 pages, he's gone from an actual sympathizer to a pacifist. And of course, this is also reflected in his own life, where, he begins by this. He actually resigns from the Vajpayee cabinet over the Gujarat 2002 riots. But towards the end of his life, he's serving in the Modi cabinet. You know, what does this say about what kind of a politician was he? Was he like a crude opportunist, or is it too much of a simplistic take on his career? You know, because there are many politicians who would fall into this spectrum of opportunism. So what is it about Paswan that makes him different? I mean, how is he different from any run-of-the-mill politician who changes colors to suit his personal ambition?
Well, it will be a reductive way to look at him. To call him an opportunist is a very simplistic explanation of his career and his life. And, before I dive into the question of or explain Paswan, the phenomena, I would like to quote a few statistics that I've also quoted in the book. This was an article that I stumbled upon by political scientist, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Gilles Vernier. And he has collated data from 2014 to 2022, in which he said that 553 Congress MLAs and 234 unsuccessful Congress candidates left the party to try their luck with different political outfit, and 233 of them subsequently won on different tickets, and 107 of them were with the BJP. And, each day we see hordes of politicians changing sides. I'm sure we need not
read too much. Are you just trying to prove my point that he's one of 500 people like him?
No. I'm just getting to the point here. I mean, so the deal is, now coming to the title, Mausam Vigyanik, that Lalu Prasad Yadav used to call him, and weather vane of Indian politics is actually a bit of an awkward translation of Mausam Vigyanik. You cannot beat the language.
Mausam Vigyanik would be like a climate doctor, right?
Or weather doctor. Kind of.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So that is what Lalu Prasad Yadav used to call him. But the interesting fact about Paswan is that unlike many of the political beings that we see today who have been shifting parties, and it just happens to be a coincidence that they have cases against him by the ED or CBI, he had always joined a coalition before the elections were announced, before going into the election. He's never joined anything midway through. So was he an opportunist? Well, I mean, it is a fact that he has changed sides, but his explanation to the whole thing is that I never changed sides midway through the process, and I've never really endangered any government. I have never...
You mean he never really waited for the ED to raid him before changing sides?
Yes, exactly. He did not. Okay. And Yeah, so he's basically his argument is that I never endangered any government. I did not harass any government or blackmail any government. I joined them, and I, whichever side I joined, they happened to win. That is his argument.
Right. I mean, that's a different way of looking at it. I mean, I'm sure that's sympathetic to how he himself viewed it. It may be, I mean, not an opportunist, maybe a survivalist, might be a less harsh way of putting it. Now, I mean, coming to the big question about his entire legacy, you know, he's a Dalit leader in a country that has seen, of course, after Ambedkar, we've had leaders like Kanshiram, Mayawati. So how do we assess his political achievements or his legacy within this pantheon of post-independent India's Dalit leaders? Because that's a question which will necessarily be raised when we talk about Ram Vilas Paswan, because he was the tallest Dalit leader, definitely from Bihar, if not, you know, a wider region.
Yeah. So, you know, some people would say that it is preposterous to compare Paswan to Kanshiram. I would have to partially agree, but no, I don't fully agree to that line. Because one thing that differentiated Kanshiram and Paswan, and I will not compare him to Mayawati so much, because I find that Kanshiram and Paswan are more contemporaneous than he and Mayawati. The thing that sort of distinguishes Kanshiram is that he, in the post-independent India, he's actually the only Dalit leader to have constructed a successful electoral vehicle in the form of Bahujan Samaj Party. And this is it, which remains unchallenged nearly four decades after its inception. And this is a feat that even Ambedkar couldn't manage to do. I mean, he couldn't really sustain or create a party. So in terms of electoral, one is hardly a match. He formed Lok Jan Shakti Party nearly two decades after the BSP came into existence. And he waded into the electoral politics, and it was much later that his consciousness that he needs to create a vehicle for Dalit emancipation, or that a vehicle that works exclusively for the Dalit rights, all that came much, much, much later. But so in terms of electoral footprint, it was very limited. Even when he brought in Lok Jan Shakti Party, at its very peak, they managed to get about 15 to 16% of vote. Bihar has about 19% Dalit population, but LJP has always averaged at getting about 5 to 6% vote. But having said that, I would like to underline that pretty much like the left, though his electoral footprint may have been limited, his voice was never proportional to the number of seats that he won. In fact, Pranab
what
Mukherjee,
explains that? Why do you think that was the case? I mean, I also was like wondering about that. He never had more than a number of seats in single digits at his command, but he always was getting nice cabinet berths in every government. Is it because of this tokenism which mainstream parties like to do with the Dalit face? Is that, did he sort of leverage that for his personal advancement? Was that what it was?
Yes, that is definitely one of the factors. Tokenism contributed to the fact that he got berths in the cabinet, and he was a face. But also you have to understand that his journey has been so long, and he has been part of, he's been a front row witness to most of the events that has happened. He had a certain amount of charisma with the media also. He had a reach. Mostly what we've seen is, especially keeping BSP in mind, BSP's sort of interaction with the media has been very, very, very limited. And unlike that, Paswan was somebody who was a media's darling, and he knew the strength of media, and he exploited it very, very well. And you know,
In
also,
that,
so
in this
obviously.
respect, in this respect, in terms of relationship with the media and building a profile for himself in New Delhi, I think there he presents a contrast with someone like Mayawati, right?
Yes, absolutely. Mayawati has always kept the media at arm's distance. She's always stayed away from the so-called Delhi's power brokers, and
I think, yeah, from with Mayawati and BSP, one also got a sense that she felt that the national media was casteist, you know, because of, you know, the Dalit factor here. And she felt that she was not getting her due. I think that never happened with Paswan. Or is it possibly also, I mean, some would argue that it's because Mayawati was a bigger threat to the status quo than Paswan was.
That is the accusation that Kanchiram has often leveled against Paswan, calling him a Thakur ka thappa. What he meant was that, and this is another sort of, we'll be wading into another problematic area here, because Kanchiram's allegation against Paswan was that he is not so much a Dalit leader as he sort of, the forward caste, the Thakur support him, and that is what sort of elevated his size and his stature. The thing about Paswan is that, though a Dalit face and though one of the tallest Dalit leaders, he did not, unlike Kanshiram or Mayawati, he was not as revolutionary, so to speak, or he wasn't as, I don't know if bitter is the right word to use, he was not so anti-forward caste. So his politics was not centered on
Should we say not as confrontational with regard to the, you know, caste elite?
yes, he, because he's, even in his last speech, he's spoken again and again that, you know, it's not necessary that for Dalits, only Dalits have to work, or a forward caste, you have to look at a forward caste person with animosity. He didn't believe in that kind of confrontational politics. So
Right. I mean, also, when I, in the early part of your book, when you talk about Paswan's early childhood years, I mean, I found it really interesting that he never felt any kind of discrimination of the kind, let's say, we have read about Ambedkar facing as a schoolboy, you know, or maybe Mayawati in her early days. I mean, he grew up in a Dalit village where everybody was a Dalit, so nobody felt that they were, you know, scheduled caste. And it's only when he went out, you know, in his later years that he felt the brunt of casteism, and that's when his political consciousness probably, you know, took shape. So maybe do you think that probably had, you know, the early years of a more secure childhood without the caste dimension getting really thrown at you all the time by upper caste or, you know, or a dominant caste entity? I think, do you think that could have had a role in shaping his
yeah,
political personality?
yes, probably. But however, if you were to look at Kanshiram's own life story, he also had a pretty similar childhood where he wasn't aware. In fact, he wasn't aware about Dalit atrocities or the fact that, what does it mean to be a Dalit, till he encountered the Mahars of Maharashtra. So there is a parallel between the two gentlemen here. Paswan, for one, I mean, one thing that if you were to ask people who have interacted with him, and the first adjective that they will use about Paswan is that he's very affable. So I believe that it was just his personality to not be confrontationalist. And as you pointed out in page 61, I've mentioned that he was an atheist to begin with. In fact, his view of how one can confront or one can remove the caste inequalities was to remove religion itself from the equation. But it was perhaps his need to pacify everyone and need to make everyone happy. When he formed his Dalit Sena, he had a clause. The entry clause was that nobody should believe in Bhagya or Bhagwan, which means fate or God. But at the first sign of disapproval, he just capitulated. At
Capitulated
the
as in he sort of removed the requirement to sort of renounce Bhagya or Bhagwan to be able to become a member of
yes,
the Dalit Sena.
yeah,
Yeah, I mean
he
that is
did.
what yeah one would call that opportunist, because you sort of let go of your basic principle at the first sign of you know pushback from a politically important entity in your space. Now, anyway, to counter all these things, Shobhanam, and the biggest argument anybody would make to make a case for Paswan as a champion of the backward castes would be his role in the implementation of the Mandal Commission report. So I was just going through the chapters on that part of his life, and I was wondering, would this Mandal Commission implementation, would it have come through, you think, if someone other than Paswan had been the social welfare minister at the time? Because nobody else seemed to have been as keen. Maybe he and Sharad Yadav, maybe together, yes, but nobody, not many others, not even VP Singh himself, according to your narration, seems to have been that keen to implement the Mandal Commission report as Paswan and Sharad Yadav were. And Paswan was the minister.
Yes, so my straightforward answer will be that I don't know whether I'm being unkind to Paswan here. That Mandal Commission was a result of the situation. It was the situation that forced everyone's hand. Now, to begin with, Janata Dal's poll promises, implementation of Mandal Commission was one of the poll promises of the Janata Dal. Paswan, you have to give him full credit that he strongly believed in this idea long before Janata Dal came into existence. And I quote in the book a speech by him on 11th August 1982, when for the first time the parliament debated Mandal Commission report, and Paswan was the first speaker. And he had strongly supported the cause and the idea. And you have to also understand, see, this is the beauty of this person, that he comes from a state where the caste schisms are such that there have been incidents of clash between prominent backward communities and Dalits, including the Belchi, the famous 1977 Belchi incident, which was basically a conflict between the Kurmis and the Dalit leader, local leader. And so despite that, he has always championed the right for backward community. So, but having given him that due credit, I would still insist that implementation of Mandal report was a result of a unique situation that had been created at that particular time. And one has to credit the coalition governments, because it is under them that, because of the various pulls and pressures, that the country manages to get a lot out. Now, National Front of 1989 was one such flagrantly mutant coalition, and which I'm sticking my neck out to say that perhaps we will not see it take shape, a similar coalition take shape anytime in the immediate future. I mean, you had Janata Dal, which was an amalgamation of various parties and interests sitting on the fulcrum. And then you had BJP and the left parties swinging unevenly from the two sides. You had several prime ministerial aspirants. Of course, VP Singh got crowned as prime minister. It was only after the script writers of the Janata Dal managed to convince Devi Lal that his own turf in Haryana will be kept secure if he was to support VP Singh. But events always overtake, especially in Indian politics with multi-party terrain that we have, events always overtake whatever ideas that one may have. Now, in 1990, there was a bipoll in Meham in Haryana, which was a seat vacated by Devi Lal. He wanted his son to contest, like all the dynasts would want, but the electorate did not want him. And the Khap Panchayats there had already given him a clear diktat that if you're not contesting, we would want to pick our person. But going against that diktat, he fielded his son O.P. Chautala. There were widespread reports of rigging. There was police firing. And overall, it created an embarrassment for V.P. Singh, who had come to power as the prophet of probity. Now, VP Singh asked Devilal to, Devilal was expelled from the government, and that happened on 1st of August 1990. You have to remember that Mandal happened soon after, because Devilal would have obviously would have tried to destabilize the government, and as an anticipatory, seeking an anticipatory bail, it was Sharad Pawar who suggested. Sharad Yadav who suggested to VP Singh that he must implement the Mandal Commission and make an immediate announcement. In fact, VP Singh wanted to wait till August 15 to use the momentous occasion and the setting of Red Fort ramparts to make the announcement. But Yadav said that he doesn't have that long. He has to make the announcement immediately. And Paswan was the cheerful and most enthusiastic supporter and lieutenant that he could have found, because he worked very hard and overnight in very limited time in a very pressured situation. He brought it out.
Right. I mean, it's very clear. I mean, there was a lot of work to be done for sure. I mean, you had to match all those various OBC castes with the state lists and the national lists and make sure that it takes a form that can be actually implemented on the ground. So, of course, there's no doubt that Paswan deserves some amount of credit for this historic legislation. I mean, historic in the sense of entire post-independent time span. Now, moving on to another very key element of your book, Shobhna, this, which is the relationship of Paswan with other two stalwarts from Bihar, Nitish Kumar and Lalu Yadav. I mean, none of them, they really weren't friends with each other, neither Nitish and Lalu nor with Paswan. So how did Paswan view these two leaders and how did they see him? Was it like love-hate relationship with each other, or was there an undercurrent of affection as well? And how did it actually work, the dynamic?
Undercurrent of affection will be something. I don't think he would have ever used that phrase for his.
I mean, they gave each other very warm hugs in front of the media. I see those photographs in your book, smiling and hugging each other. So that made me wonder.
Yes, surely. I mean, between Nitish Kumar and Lalu Yadav, he still shared a better relationship with Lalu Yadav, although. In politics, there are no permanent relationship. There are no permanent likes and dislikes. But in case of Nitish Kumar, it was a deeply organic feeling. See, one has to understand, Paswan believed and he firmly believed that he's a political senior to both of them. When he
was
already
in college
elected,
together with Nitish, they were in the same college around the same time, right?
No. So when, that's what I'm coming to. In 1969, when Paswan becomes the legislator, Lalu and Nitish are both still in college. Lalu is just about sort of warming up and he's trying his hand in university politics. And Nitish Kumar is still reading tomes and tomes about socialism. See, between the three people, Lalu and Paswan are very organic leaders who have learned the syntax, the language of backward and Dalit politics as they went through practice. But while Nitish Kumar is a scholar and has always been a scholar, he comes from a family which has well read, which has studied, and three generations before him were also literate and educated. That's not the case with Lalu or Paswan. In both their cases, they're the first one to see what a college looks like. So there is that. But off and on, Paswan and Lalu have collaborated. But in fact, at Lok Jan Shakti Party's peak, it was Paswan who sort of had set the target that he will not let RJD to return. And one thing Paswan was far more powerful than Lalu in the architecture of Janata Dal in the early years in terms of ranks. And he, what What surprised me during this entire research was that for a person who's known for his prescience, for known for his clairvoyance, he actually did not see foresee Lalu Yadav's growth or the growth of the Yadav vote bank. He did not foresee that. But even after the early two, there's a whole chapter on the two elections in the year 2005, when Pasvan came close to becoming the chief minister of Bihar, and he chose not to, and the whole gambit, the failed gambit of trying to stall Lalu Prasad Yadav and the RJD from gaining power. But the relationship between him and Nitish Kumar was bitter, and there were no sweet moments there at all. I mean, Nitish Kumar thought that Pasvan is far too flamboyant a character. He's too outspoken. He doesn't measure his words. And it was just a very deep dislike for each other. And Pasvan didn't like Nitish Kumar's intrigues that he sort of accused him of playing. And in fact, one of the last insults, so to speak, in Pasvan's life also came from Nitish Kumar, which I've recounted in the book. And this was told to me by Pasvan himself during the Rajya Sabha, his last stint in parliament, and this time as a Rajya Sabha member, he had to depend on Nitish Kumar and the Janata Dal U for support. And despite the fact that they had already, the seat sharing arrangement had already been fixed, Nitish Kumar made Ram Vilas Paswan beg for support. And this was a humiliation that he never ever.
But if you were Nitish Kumar, after all that Paswan had done to you, you know, so many times he tried to stop you from becoming chief minister, all those things, wouldn't you also do the same?
I don't know. Maybe you need to get me a time machine and I need to go back and see.
Yeah. I mean, he has done a lot of things to irritate and annoy Nitish, right? I mean, isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I said. No,
at the end of it, you expect Nitish Kumar to lay out the red carpet for you when you want a Rajya Sabha seat.
Yes, very wrong, very wrong on both parts.
Right. Yeah, but nonetheless, it's an interesting dynamic show. A couple of quick questions. No, this Dalit Sena, which you've written about, which Pasvan sets up, it begins in a very promising way. A huge number of people, but then it's also not. I don't know how does it compare with something like the Bheem Army? The uniforms seem to be somewhat similar, you know, blue and white or something like that. So, is it still active today? Is it disbanded? What is the status of this Dalit Sena?
Yeah, so I think there is a lot of similarity between the two. Because much like Chandrasekhar Azad's Bheem Army, Bheem Army is entirely dependent on Chandrasekhar Azad's own profile, own portfolio. I mean, it draws energy from him. And similarly, the Dalit Sena was a concept that Pasvan, after having been in electoral politics for nearly two decades, he decides to construct a organization like Dalit Sena, which he says that will work only for the Dalits and will go across the country wherever any incident of atrocity has happened. The Sena members will be present to help the victims, which is what we see with the Bheem Army too. As on date, it still stands, but it is not active. Its members are all scattered all over. And the problem with the Dalits, and you know, the problem with not only Dalit Sena here, I want to make a broader point also. In Indian politics, seemingly, we've had lack of movements per se. I mean, we had independence movement, but in the last seven decades, we haven't really... the sort of the reservation for Dalits is something, it's a constitutional right that was granted at the beginning of the of this nation. It was not something that came out of a movement, at least in North India, there wasn't a similar movement as we have seen, say, in Maharashtra or the southern states, where we had a strong Dravidian movement and we had a strong anti-caste movement, Iruva movement of Kerala. In Northern India, in the Hindi heartland, we haven't seen a similar movement. And this is exactly what we see with Dalit Sena also. Here is a leader who has been in electoral politics for two decades. He is a darling of media. He's here in Delhi. And then once he has already reached a certain level in politics, he decides now he applies the reverse gear and tries to construct an organization which is completely dependent on his own personality. And Dalit Sena's peaks are same as Paswan's own peaks. Unlike Bhim Army or unlike even the BSP's, the Bamsef or Kanshiram's initial movements, this has a very sort of a humble ideas and humble targets. It says that, yes, I cannot do, I cannot bring lunch. Therefore, I will just make my little humble contribution by lighting a small lamp wherever I can.
Now that Paswan is no more, is it still active, the Dalit Sena?
Not so much. It has its members. I think it's more like one of your fantasy fiction things where you can blow a horn and bring them to life. There are still members across, right. But it is not active. They will need that horn to be blown.
So Shobhana, Paswan resigned from the Vajpayee cabinet in 2002 over the Gujarat riots. And it was along expected lines. Many of the allies at the time had expressed, some form of condemnation over, the way the administration responded to the riots in the aftermath of this whole Godhra thing. But we find that over the years, he has sort of moved away from that position. We don't really know whether that resignation was purely one based on principle or was there other calculations going on. But he did the ultimate flip-flop by not just joining Narendra Modi's cabinet in Delhi, but singing his praises at every turn, including his last few years in the cabinet. So how do we understand this U-turn? Does this represent the limitations of what one might call the agency of a Dalit politician in independent India's parliamentary democracy, the one where, of course, which is a legacy of the Pune Pact, the infamous Pune Pact, which denied separate electorates for Dalits, which you also refer to in your book?
You know, the clue to your question about the limitation of Dalit politics, there is, and as Paswan had often spoken about, there is not a single reserved seat in India where the Dalit population is in majority. Therefore, for a Dalit politician to operate, something that he also spoke about in his very last parliamentary speech, is you cannot take a very Dalit-centric stand alone. You have to placate a lot of other interests to get the work done. And this is something that he has always lamented throughout his, and which is lamented by many Dalit politicians, that had the Pune Pact not happened and had we listened to Ambedkar's proposal of separate electorates, things would have been far different for the Dalit
Paswan looked there, would it be correct to say that it's not enough for a Dalit politician in India today if, say, 100% of all the Dalits were happy with him? He has to be necessarily someone who is also acceptable to the non-Dalits, the dominant caste and the upper caste. Only then he will be able to make any kind of headway.
Yes, Yes. And especially in sort of rural India, this is more true than ever. I mean, we have told whenever all my senior colleagues have always told me that whenever you go for election coverage, make sure that you go deep into the villages and not talk to the people who are sitting in the main roads, because more often than not, they're the ones who are more noisy and they're the ones who will influence the voting patterns. And they are the ones who are the decision makers. But they may not be reflective of the actual sentiment. So, and in rural India, people just have to flow with whatever is the dominant view. So, the dominant, and that is a problem that all our Dalit leaders face today, that there is not a single constituency where it is enough for having support from the Dalits. You have to have the support of the dominant castes, and that is a problem, and that is an allegation that even Paswan faced. So coming to his exit on from the Vajpayee government on 2002 riots, he said this and noted this in the book on the basis of the fact that he, as the telecom minister, faced a lot of resistance from the Vajpayee administration in several decision-making processes. And he was not entirely independent in the decision making. There was a lot of interference that he complained from the Prime Minister's office, as well as Pramod Mahajan, who succeeded him in the ministry, and the reshuffle. When Vajpayee reshuffled the cabinet, he was the portfolio, the telecom portfolio, was unceremoniously taken away from him. And he came to know about the reshuffle and reassignment through television tickers. So obviously he was deeply humiliated, and therefore he believed that he needs to get out of the government. Maybe it was an emotive issue. It was emotive enough to push him out of the government. And maybe there were political calculations. He believed that if a Dalit leader is to exit. And then he found this opportune time with the riots. And there were discussions, and all the allies were deeply discomforted by the BJP and their strong support for Narendra Modi and literal anointment of Narendra Modi as the future of the BJP. So everybody was discomforted by the events. And for Paswan, I am not doubting that he was... I'm not doubting the fact that he was uncomfortable. I am not doubting that at all. But I do believe that he used that particular opportunity to register his protest. And probably he expected more of public support on the basis of his move. That somehow did not happen. And he was in the political oblivion, so to speak, for 2 years, till Sonia Gandhi actually walked from her house to his. They shared a wall. They were neighbors for most of each other's lives, and she actually walked over to her house and welcomed him to the United Progressive Alliance.
Of course, one cannot doubt Paswan's secular credentials, but there is also the fact, as you said, the way he felt treated in the telecom ministry, in the PMO interfering, he didn't get a free hand. And of course, the unceremonial taking away of the ministry from him. And I think he got shunted to mining or some other ministry, which he did not appreciate.
Yes.
So I think the 2002 riots gave him an opportunity to sort of come out of this and register his protest, while also possibly getting some kind of political mileage in terms of projecting that he was taking a principled stand. But I think also, as you say in your book, he never mentioned the Chief Minister of Gujarat at that time, Narendra Modi, by name, either in the press conference when he resigned or I think in his speeches, right? Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I did not find any evidence that the animosity was directed at Narendra Modi as such.
Right. So last question, Shobhana, before we wrap up. So now that his son, I think, is in charge of the LJP, how do you see Ram Vilas Paswan's legacy, the political party he set up in the phase post-Ram Vilas phase, so to speak?
So one thing one must have, one must say that in though in UP we have a BSP, Bihar surprisingly hasn't ever had a political party that was headed by a Dalit leader, founded by a Dalit leader, and sustained by a Dalit leader. So this is one legacy that Lok Jan Shakti Party that Ram Vilas Paswan established is the his legacy vehicle, and which is successfully running. Even the only experiment so far that LJP has had is the first elections that came soon after Paswan's death. There also LJP managed to hold on to its 5 to 6% vote share that it usually gets, although it was completely annihilated and it did not win barring one seat, it did not win any other seat. But that was because Chirag Paswan, his son, had taken this very curious stand of standing outside the NDA and opposing Nitish Kumar, making it an emotive issue that his father was humiliated by Nitish Kumar, and therefore he ran the entire campaign against, his campaign was centered against his animosity with Nitish Kumar. And this time we are again, the elections are a few weeks from now, and Chirag Paswan is back with the NDA. Unlike his father, the two creatures are very, very different. Obviously the party split in 2021 between the son and the brother, but it is very clear, BJP has also made it very clear by picking Chirag Paswan over his uncle, that the Paswan vote and the heir of the Paswan legacy is the son, Chirag Paswan. And I believe in the coming weeks, we will have further evidence to support this belief of mine that if Chirag Paswan is to continue with the NDA, he will manage to sustain the party and manage to get the roundabout same amount of votes as the party used to get in Paswan's own lifetime.
He's in the NDA, Nitish is also in the NDA. What happens to the Chirag and Nitish's relationship going forward? Is it going to be full of animus as before, or
the animus has not died away? In fact, the Mahagathbandhan was hoping and banking on the fact that now that both are back again in the same side, that Chirag Paswan could be persuaded to come over to their side, citing his own public stand in the previous assembly elections. But somehow they've not managed to swing it. But both of them, Chirag Paswan and Ram Vilas Paswan, are very, very distinct individuals.
Right. And I think, you had a report out, I think, yesterday, where you had said that LJP has managed to get 5 seats for the national elections and on seat sharing understanding.
Yes, yes.
Right. Thank you so much, Shobhana. It was an absolute pleasure discussing Ram Vilas Paswan and the times of Ram Vilas Paswan with you. This is a fascinating book, and I think listeners who have been listening in, if they enjoyed this conversation, I would urge them to go and buy a copy. It's been a wonderful conversation and a great experience discussing national and Bihar politics with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Sampath.
Thank you for listening to The Hindu on Books. You can now find The Hindu's podcasts such as In Focus and Parlay on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other major platforms. Write to us with comments and feedback at socmed4@thehindu.co.in.